Okay, so you're listening to another audio essay. This one is a seasonal special. Given the day that's in it, I'm releasing this on Easter Sunday, I thought I would do something on Hume's argument on miracles. This particular audio essay is going to be an analysis based on a book written by Alexander George a couple of years back on Hume's argument against miracles. So I hope you enjoy this audio essay. I just want to say at the outset, I don't normally do this kind of thing, but if you enjoy this podcast in general and would like to kind of promote it or support it in some way, I would appreciate if you shared it with friends or colleagues, and also if you offered a rating or review of it on the various podcatching apps that are out there. That would help to spread the word about the podcast. Don't worry, that's all I'm going to ask for at this point in time. I have no intention to start begging for money at the outset of every podcast, since I effectively do this for free. Okay, without any further ado, let's talk about Hume's argument against miracles. The Everlasting Check: Understanding Hume's Argument Against Miracles. I have discovered an argument which, if just, will, with the wise and learned, be an everlasting check to all kinds of superstitious delusion. Miraculous events lie at the heart of most religions. Jesus' resurrection from the dead, Moses' parting of the Red Sea, Muhammad's journeys on the back of a winged horse, Joseph Smith's shenanigans with the angel Moroni. All of these events are, in common parlance, miraculous. If you wish to be a religious believer, you must accept the historical occurrence of at least some of these originating miraculous events. The problem is that you don't get to observe them, to verify them with your own eyes. You must rely on the testimony of others, often handed down to you through religious texts or oral histories. Is this testimonial evidence ever sufficient to warrant belief in the miraculous? David Hume famously argued that it wasn't. In his essay Of Miracles, which appears as section 10 of his larger work An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, Hume argues that testimonial evidence is unlikely to ever be sufficient to warrant belief in a miraculous event. Hume's argument has been the subject of much interpretation and debate over the past 250 or so years. Much of that debate obscures or misrepresents what Hume actually stated. Fortunately, the philosopher Alexander George has recently published a beautiful exposition and analysis of Hume's argument, titled The Everlasting Check, Hume on Miracles, which corrects the record on a number of key points. George's analysis is somewhat similar to that of Robert Fogelin, which I've actually written about previously. In essence, both authors argue that Hume's argument is routinely misinterpreted as providing an a priori, or in principle, case against the possibility of testimonial proof of miracles. But this is emphatically not what Hume argues. Hume merely argues that testimonial proof of the miraculous is extremely unlikely. The mistake stems from the fact that Hume's essay is broken into two parts, and many people assume that both parts present two separate arguments, an a priori argument in part 1, and an a posteriori argument in part 2. But they do not. Both parts must be read together as presenting one single argument. Although Fogelin and George reach similar conclusions, they do so by subtly different means. George's exposition has the advantage of being more thorough, more up-to-date, and ultimately more straightforward. On top of that, George makes some important points about how Hume defines miracles and how he relates the evidence for the occurrence of natural laws to the evidence of the reliability of testimony. So when you understand these points, much of Hume's argument falls neatly into place. So what I want to do over the remainder of this essay is to share George's analysis of Hume's argument, and by the end I'm hoping that the listener will appreciate both the strengths and, crucially, the limitations of Hume's analysis. So part 1. The basic structure of Hume's argument. Hume's argument is about the proof of miracles, but what actually is a miracle? Hume is pretty clear about this. He defines a miracle as a violation of the laws of nature. But this definition raises a further question. What is a law of nature? Some people argue that a law of nature is an exceptionalist pattern in the natural world. The law of energy conservation, or the second law of thermodynamics, would be common examples. But to say that a particular law is an exceptionalist pattern is also somewhat ambiguous. Is the pattern truly exceptionalist? In other words, is the pattern some ontological necessity that has been hardwired into the universe? Or is it simply the case that we have never observed an exception? In other words, is it merely an epistemic inference from our observations? George argues that Hume favored a strictly epistemic understanding of the laws of nature. He viewed laws of nature as well-confirmed regularities. We say that there is a law of conservation of energy because we have never observed energy coming into being from nothing. We have only ever observed it being changed from one form to another. But who knows? Maybe someday we will observe an exception, and this exception will itself be well confirmed, and hence we will have to revise our original conception of the law. That said, laws of nature are, for Hume, very, very well confirmed. We usually have the strongest possible epistemic evidence in their favor. This epistemic understanding of miracles is consistent with Hume's general empiricism, and it allows for miracles to come in degrees. An event can be more or less miraculous, depending on how well confirmed the regularity with which it is inconsistent really is. Indeed, Hume himself distinguished so-called marvels from miracles on the grounds that the former were inconsistent with less well-confirmed regularities than the latter. This is all by way of saying that Hume's target in his argument against miracles is best understood in the following manner. This is a revised definition of a miracle for Hume, which states that a miracle is a violation of a very well-confirmed regularity that is observed in the natural world. So much for the target of Hume's argument. What of the argument itself? That argument has a very simple structure, consisting of two premises and a conclusion. Now, George uses mathematical terminology to describe the two premises of the argument, referring to them as the first lemma and the second lemma, respectively. He also refers to the conclusion of Hume's argument as a theorem. I will follow suit here, although I don't strictly think that this mathematical terminology is necessary. So the first premise or lemma of the argument is this. If the falsehood of testimony on behalf of an alleged miraculous religious event is not more miraculous than the event itself, then it is not rational to believe in the occurrence of that event on the basis of that testimony. The second premise, or lemma, states that the falsehood of the testimony that we have on behalf of alleged religious miraculous events is not more miraculous than those events themselves. And this then leads to the conclusion, Hume's theorem, which is that it is not rational to believe in miraculous religious events on the basis of testimony. Now, I have modified the wording of the lemmas and the theorem slightly from how they appear in George's original text. I did this in order to make the argument more logically coherent and more consistent with Hume's aims. As we'll see, Hume doesn't try to argue against all possible testimonial proofs of the miraculous, merely against the historical testimonial proof that is usually provided on behalf of all the major world religions. Indeed, Hume specifies under what conditions it might be acceptable to believe in a miracle on the basis of testimony. For those who care about how this argument maps onto the structure of Hume's original essay on miracles, the first lemma of the argument is defended in the first part of the essay, and the second lemma is defended in the second part. Again, and to reiterate what was said previously, it is important that we don't disconnect the two parts of Hume's essay. You cannot derive Hume's theorem from the first part alone, and this is a mistake that many interpreters have made in the past. This brings us then to part two of the essay. How do we establish the first lemma of Hume's argument? Now, the first lemma of Hume's argument is what has generated most of the debate and controversy in the past. It is significant because it states a general principle or test that should apply to the evaluation of testimonial evidence. As such, it has significance beyond the debate about the occurrence of religious miracles, although that's how Hume applies it. So here's how Hume introduces the general principle, and this is a quote directly from Hume's essay. Hume states, "No testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. And even in that case, there is a mutual destruction of the arguments, and the superior only gives us an assurance suitable to that degree of force which remains after deducting the inferior." Now, to retranslate that, the basic idea in this passage is that The evidence we have in favor of the laws of nature is very, very strong. We have observed the same regularities over and over again. So our epistemic confidence in their status is very, very high. A miraculous event, by definition, contradicts these well-observed regularities. So to believe in the occurrence of a miracle, we would need to have even stronger evidence in favor of its occurrence than we do in favor of the laws of nature. When the evidence supplied comes in the shape of testimony, then we will only reach this threshold when the probability of the testimony being false is lower, i.e. more miraculous, than the probability of the miracle itself. Now, the major philosophical problem with this analysis is that it relies on the commensurability of the testimonial evidence in favor of the miraculous and evidence in favor of the laws of nature. In order to establish that the respective probabilities of the two propositions, that the testimony is false and that the miracle is true, we would need to establish some common metric along which those probabilities can be measured. And this is where Hume made his most important philosophical contribution to the debate. He argued that all evidence ultimately stems from our observations of the world around us. Any particular proposition that we hold to be true about the world, for example, that dead men stay dead, that energy is conserved, and that there is a universal tendency toward increased entropy, is ultimately warranted by observations we have made about the world. This is clearly true for the laws of nature, but it is also true for testimonial proofs as well. And this point is critical. The reason why we are usually confident of testimony is because there is a well-confirmed regularity to the effect that when someone says that an event occurred, it usually did occur. To put it in another way, Hume is saying that there is a law of testimony, like a law of nature, and this law of testimony is grounded in our experiences of the relationship between testimony and events in the real world. Now, drawing out this equivalence is critical to Hume's project, and it is a point that interpreters of Hume often miss, according to George. It is only through establishing this equivalence that Hume is entitled to say that we can meaningfully compare the relative probabilities of testimonial proof and a law of nature. As George puts it in his discussion of Hume, given Hume's central commensurating analysis in part one of his essay, it is indeed meaningful to evaluate whether the relation is greater than holds between an event's occurrence and a testimony's falsehood, because we can now appreciate that there is a law-like claim about nature with which the falsehood of that testimony conflicts. And this equivalence is what justifies the general principle stated in Hume's first premise or first lemma. We are only warranted in believing in a miracle on the basis of testimony if the warrant for the law of testimony in that instance outweighs the warrant for the law of nature. And this only happens when the falsehood of that testimony is more improbable than the falsehood of the law of nature. Now, this brings us to the next part of the essay, establishing the second lemma of Hume's argument. So the first lemma is interesting in and of itself, but it doesn't get us anywhere close to establishing that it is irrational to believe in historically testified miracles. Obviously, the suspicion underlying the first lemma is that the warrant we have for the law of testimony is much weaker than the warrant we have for any candidate law of nature. After all, even though testimony is usually accurate, there are plenty of times when it isn't. People misunderstand what they have seen. They fabulate and overinterpret. They suffer from confirmation bias, whereby they assume that what they saw is consistent with their prior beliefs and desires. They also, sometimes, lie outright for their own gain. Now, the purpose of the second lemma of Hume's argument is to establish that the law of testimony breaks down in the case of historically testified miracles. In other words, that the falsehood of the testimony in favor of historical miraculous events is not more miraculous than the events themselves. Hume does this by setting out four main lines of argument in favor of the second lemma, and these can be briefly summarized in the following way. The first argument, he states, is a reliability argument. He says that testimonial evidence is strongest when it meets certain conditions of reliability, specifically when it comes from many different witnesses. These witnesses are of good sense, education, and integrity. The witnesses have reputations that could be tarnished by the evidence they are presenting. And the witnesses testify to an event that occurred in public and so would have enabled detection of fraud. Hume's contention is that the evidence for religious miracles doesn't meet these conditions of reliability. The second argument Hume offers in support of the second lemma is the so-called propensity to the marvelous argument. Hume points out that people in general have a propensity to the marvelous. As he puts it, the passion of surprise and wonder arising from miracles, being an agreeable emotion, gives a sensible tendency towards the belief of those events from which it is derived. We love to partake of satisfaction at second hand or by rebound, and place a pride and delight in exciting the admiration of others. In other words, we have an emotional tendency to accept and repeat claims of the miraculous. What's more, this tendency is even higher in the case of religious miracles, because the authority and power that is often granted to accepted religious prophets and missionaries is desirable. This means that there is a tendency to trade emotional satisfaction for accuracy of testimony. This might not be done deliberately, it may be done entirely subconsciously, but it still undermines the credibility of any testimony of the miraculous. The third argument that Hume offers in support of the second lemma is the so-called ignorant and barbarous peoples argument. And the idea behind this argument is that the people from whom testimony of historical religious miracles emanates are ignorant and barbarous. In other words, they were likely to be predisposed to credulity of the miraculous and to misunderstanding events that actually occurred. Furthermore, they were not skeptical and disinterested observers in the modern sense. Now, obviously, Hume's language in expressing this argument is antiquated and un-PC, but I think the point still holds. The fourth argument that Hume makes in support of the second lemma is the so-called end-to-common-sense argument. So the idea here is this. When it comes to religious affairs in general, Hume argues that there is an end of common sense. In other words, people don't follow common-sense rules of reasoning and inference when it comes to religious matters. Systems of religious thought tend to blind people to the truth, and we should consequently weigh religious claims accordingly. Hume uses a thought experiment to make his point here. He asks us to imagine a group of people who testified to the resurrection of Elizabeth I in order to found a new system of religion. How much weight would we accord their testimony? Very little, Hume suggests. He says that all men of sense would reject the fact without further examination. But if we apply this kind of common sense reasoning in the case of the resurrection of Elizabeth I, why don't we apply it in the case of a much older miraculous event, namely, of course, the resurrection of Jesus, although Hume doesn't directly mention it. Now, the first and third of these arguments have to do with the credibility and reliability of the witnesses we have for religious miracles. The strength of these arguments depends on how accurately they represent the historical record. The second and fourth arguments are more general and focus on people's tendency to be misled when it comes to the marvelous and the miraculous, particularly when it is religious in nature. It is important to emphasize that these arguments do not undermine all testimony in favor of miracles. Hume is very clear about this. He thinks it would be possible to have a proof of a miracle that overcomes the test established in the first lemma of his argument. Indeed, he uses a thought experiment, the so-called 8 days of darkness thought experiment, to illustrate the conditions under which testimony would provide compelling proof of the miraculous. The thought experiment asks us to imagine that all authors in all languages agree that from the 1st of January 1600, there was total darkness over the whole earth for 8 days. Suppose that the tradition of this extraordinary event is still strong and lively among the people, that all travelers who return from foreign countries bring us accounts of the same tradition without the least variation or contradiction. In that case, you might have grounds to think that the testimony of a miraculous event outweighs the probability of the miracle not being true. Now, this admittedly sets a high bar, but that's what we would expect when testimony is going up against a law of nature, and it at least shows that testimony might, on some occasions, be sufficient to provide grounds for believing in miraculous. What about the limitations of Hume's argument? Now, Hume's argument has many limitations. My belief is that the general principle established in the first lemma is fairly robust. It is difficult to see how else testimony could override a law of nature. But the arguments in support of the second lemma are much less robust. If you read any religious apologetics, you will know that the first and third arguments, those concerning the reliability of the witnesses in question, are highly contested. Apologists introduce all sorts of arguments for thinking that the testimony we have is more reliable than Hume claims. For instance, in relation to the resurrection of Jesus, apologists often argue that we do have multiple witnesses, perhaps as many as 500, and that some of them were well-educated and disinterested, and that some of them did suffer greatly for what they believed. Now, I personally tend to think that Hume is still, broadly speaking, correct and that apologetical arguments on this front ultimately fail, but clearly a lot more work would need to be done to address each and every one of these contentions and thereby shore up the argument for the second lemma. I also think that the second and fourth arguments are pretty contentious, those about the general propensity to end common sense or believe in the miraculous. Hume is certainly onto something in these arguments. There are lots of putative miracle claims out there, and systems of religious thought sometimes do come with benefits for believers which may cause them to be more credulous than they ought to be. Furthermore, psychological evidence suggests that we do have a propensity to over-ascribe agency to events in the natural world and to misinterpret what our senses have shown us. These errors probably do lie at the foundation of many miraculous claims, but to dismiss all religion as anathema to common sense and rationality seems to go too far to me. I think, along with Oscar Wilde, that common sense is not that common, and that it is a mistake to assume that, say, secular or non-religious people have some innate epistemic superiority over the religious brethren. I think it's much more complicated than that. Despite this, I would argue that Hume provides a pretty good framework for evaluating religious miracle claims, and that while he may be wrong, or maybe too superficial and glib on some of the critical details, anyone who cares about this issue in the modern day plays on the terrain that he defined nearly three centuries ago.